Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on what time you're looking at this podcast. This podcast series we call Race, Culture, and the Church. Race, Culture, and the Church. And as I like to remind everyone, think of it like a Venn diagram, you know, where you have a circle of race, circle of culture, circle of church, and where they intersect is where we like to land. Definitely hit 2 out of 3 every time. And 3 out of 3, that's wonderful. This series started 1 week after the murder of George Floyd, and we've continued on till this day. And I am pleased, I am honored to have in this space Dr. Christopher Towler, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at California State University, Sacramento.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Pleasure being here. Thank you.
Thank you. Stingers up. I am an alum from the School of Engineering, class of 1980, long before you were born, but that's okay.
Not quite, but...
Not very close, though, yeah. I'm sure. Sac State has changed, call it Sac State, has changed quite a bit. It has grown. You almost need a map or a GPS to get around. It's grown. Student body is now what? Roughly 30,000?
I was going to say approaching 40K probably.
40,000.
With wow. graduate students and everybody, yeah.
Wow. Wow. The School of Political Science is how big?
You know, we've got a good core faculty. Every year, at least a couple hundred majors. So it's growing. It's one of the larger majors on campus. And pretty much since, you know, 2008 and the attention that politics has gained nationally, political science departments across the country have been growing and student enrollment has been increasing. So we're lucky.
Before I even introduce you, what do you attribute the, you just said, you gave one tease, because of the dialogue that's going on now, what do you see someone who would graduate in this with a degree, where are they going? There's only so many seats, and I don't think you're going to give yours up anytime soon as associate professor at Sac State.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long road to move from undergrad to academic, right? There's tons of different hoops and hurdles you have to go through, not just with graduate school, but through the academic job market. But here at Sac State, you know, students are lucky enough to be in the capital of one of the largest political economies in the country and even the world. And so there's opportunities for them to not just go directly into politics, but to work, you know, have a foot in politics here that sends them possibly to DC or to LA or to the Bay Area or to other large political environments across the country. And so, you know, the students here who come out of the political science department, some go to law school, right? Some look towards something outside of politics altogether, but many of them are able to cultivate experiences in the capital city that allow them to go directly into political careers, either working for representatives on campaigns for nonprofits or think tanks. And so, you know, I've been had the pleasure of seeing a number of students go through the program and end up very, very placed very nicely, right, for what they want to do with the rest of their life.
It's interesting. Let me just go ahead and introduce you. Again, you're associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Sac State. So I'll just read this. Your research and teaching focuses on American politics, race, and ethnicity, and methodology. You examine ideological predispositions, political alienation, wow, isn't that timely?
Yes.
Allegiance and support, with most recent work exploring the interaction between progressive social movements and far-right reactions to major social change. Definitely want to talk about that. You received your doctorate and your master's from the University of Washington in Seattle and your bachelor's from the University of Colorado. Former McNair and Ralph Bunch scholar. You received McNair Graduate and Ford Foundation pre-doctoral and dissertation fellowships, and your work appears in Perspectives on Politics, Journal of Race, Ethnicity, and Politics, and the Du Bois Review. Currently serve as editor-in-chief of the Journal of Race, Ethnicity, and Politics, and directs the Black Voter Project, where I had the pleasure of meeting you, a national survey project of Black Americans. And your work has been featured in The Bee, Politico, The Washington Post, Time Magazine, USA Today, and The Atlantic. And there were four published articles that really caught my attention. Again, this the first two were in 2020, Race and Racism in U.S. Campaigns, Shut Up and Play, Black Athletes, Protests, Politics, and Black Political Action. In 2018, Race and Authoritarianism in American Politics. And in 2011, around the time of President Obama, The Tea Party in the Age of Obama, a Mainstream Conservatism or an Outgroup Anxiety. I think the answer has been borne out since 2011.
Yes, it's shown itself very clearly, yeah.
You're from Colorado. What inspired you to go into political science way back when you were a little one? And how did Dr. Towler end up in Sacramento having a conversation with Mark Meeks?
There's a short and long version. I'll start with the short version. Like so many young college students, you go into the university not exactly knowing what you want to do. And so I went in thinking that I was going to play sports. I walked onto the football team for a while and ended up having to focus primarily on academics in order to make it by. But I went in similar to you as an engineering student. And I loved math. I thought that's where I was going to fall in love. But after taking a few history classes, I found myself moving more towards the social sciences. And I ended up in my junior year fully moving towards political science with the intention to go to law school, as I had read a number of books, but one of which stood out to me, which was the autobiography of Geronimo Pratt, who was the LA leader of the Black Panther Party. And it ended up being the first case that Johnny Cochran ever worked on. And one of the sort of defining moments of my childhood was watching my dad sit on the couch and watch endlessly the O.J. Simpson trial. And that's something that, you know, influenced my interest in law and piqued my interest at a young age. So then reading this book in college on Geronimo Pratt and hearing about how Johnny Cochran came of age as a young civil rights lawyer, basically with that case. And it's the only one of the only cases, his first case and one of the only cases he actually lost. And so that pushed me sort of full force away from the engineering and into social sciences, specifically political science, with the intention of going to law school. At that point, though, I also fell into the Ronald McNair program at the University of Colorado. I was working through much of college, and this program offered a somewhat nice stipend to take additional classes. And the purpose of these programs across the country were to encourage students from underrepresented backgrounds to look at research and graduate school. And the few classes I took, you know, I fell in love with research. And I didn't even know this was an option prior to the McNair program. But once I started taking the McNair classes, the research methodology classes, teaching you not only about what research is, but how you would do research if you pursued a graduate degree. And I shifted within political science from law school to graduate school with the intention at that point to try and continue on and get an MA and a PhD and be a researcher. And that's really how I ended up, you know, into political science in a roundabout way. And then the first position I got after the University of Washington, where I finished my PhD, was at Western Washington University, which was a smaller liberal arts school up in Bellingham, Washington, about 30 minutes or so, 30, 45 minutes from the Canadian border. But I was really wanting to teach and study Black politics. And so I was looking for a university in an area that had more diversity, more resources, and more sort of networks of scholars in Sacramento State. You know, a job became available. I applied for it. It looked like the perfect place to continue my agenda. And, you know, I've been able to do so in ways that I never imagined. And if you look at sort of the way that Sacramento State is moving now when it comes to race and politics and research and culture in those areas, I, you know, again, never imagined I would be where I'm at in this moment in Sac State, in some ways sort of leading the nation and pushing back against some of these calls to NDEI and to stop discussions and reverse course when it comes to becoming more equitable and inclusive.
I know you couldn't have imagined that you'd be in the, I would say, the eye of the storm or the center of the target, if you will.
Right.
It's akin to what I'd liken it to buying Apple stock when it was Wozniak and Jobs. And now look at it, you know,
yeah.
and where you're at now. Do you consider yourself, you're a professor, obviously. Are you a researcher first? Are you a professor? Where does the research and the academic, what's the order and how do they mesh
yeah.
for Dr. Towler?
For me, they're not one and the same, but they go hand in hand. And one thing that I've enjoyed doing is using my research to help teach students, but then also using the discussions and classroom experience to help inform my research. And so they inform one another and balance one another in many ways that I love research, but I also love the work in the classroom. And oftentimes I'll talk about something in the classroom that I'm researching or that I'm thinking about researching, and I'll have a conversation with students that will open up doors to new research avenues or push me in a direction that I never thought of before. Similarly, I'll present research that I've done to students, research that might be new or unique or very specific to, say, the Black community. And the students will gain a perspective from that that they won't get anywhere else. Again, because it's my specific research, it's not something that's going to be easily found or pushed out there in textbooks or in sort of the mainstream curriculum. And so for me, they go hand in hand. They help and assist one another. Sometimes they push back against one another. Mm. But the research and the teaching all makes up my identity as an academic and a scholar. And, you know, I couldn't see one without the other at this point.
I appreciate that. Give me an example of something that came up in discussion or from a student that I won't say was necessarily an aha moment, but really, oh, that's interesting. I hadn't considered that.
So I was teaching in 2017, it was 2016, 2017 at Western Washington University, my first year on the job, coming out of graduate school. And it was, you know, the few months or so after the murder of Trayvon Martin, and we started to see protests pop up. And one of the things that my classes continuously talked about were the athletes protesting and the role that athletes would play. At first, it was WNBA players, and then Colin Kaepernick started to become famous or infamous for taking a knee. And then you had NBA players, LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, protesting, starting to fall in line or sort of line up with the Black Lives Matter movement that had started in the wake of Trayvon Martin. And from that, I took what the students were saying, what they were interested in, what they were talking about, and decided to measure it nationally on one of the first Black Voter Project surveys I ran, actually a pilot study I ran in 2017, where I actually asked people about their opinion of these athletes, specifically Colin Kaepernick, protesting in this moment. That then turned into a much larger research agenda and eventually a publication, one of which you mentioned, showing that these national athletes, these protests that professional athletes put on actually do matter. They do influence people. Not only are people paying attention to them, but if people are supportive of these athletes, if people see these athletes' protests as important, it's more likely to make them politically engaged. And so that's something that started in the classroom and then kind of ended up full circle as an entire research agenda, culminating into what's come to be one of my most cited publications.
Do you, I'm not sure what I'm going to ask, but I'll throw it out there. Do you see the engagement that you described? Has your experience, has your history shown that the engagement leads to tangible, dare I say, sustainable action? We live in a time, I need to tell you, where a lot of folks, a microwave was all they ever knew. I'm old enough to know life before a microwave. And I use that as an example of expectation that if I put in a bag of kernels, popcorn, in 3 minutes, I'm going to get a hot, buttery package of popcorn. And you know, stuff on TV is finished in 27 minutes. It's all wrapped up. It's neat. In your experience, does it show a willingness to work through the gnarliness of desired results, fully recognizing that this is going to take a lot of work. There's a lot of layers to whatever it is. Or is it, okay, well, that was last week's cause du jour. Let's move on to the next one.
Yeah, that's a really loaded question. For me, this might be where the research and the sort of understanding or learning of political history oftentimes helps me inform my students. Because that's one of the big questions that comes up in my classes all the time is, are we really making a difference? Is it really worth it? Is politics really useful? And understanding or helping them understand their action in a specific political moment can be best done, in my opinion, by teaching them about our country's long political history. And that from the start, much of American politics was designed to be pretty darn exclusive. Mm-hmm. There was nothing that was extremely egalitarian about it. It was mostly meant for a very select few white property-owning men, if you will.
Correct.
And we've had to push hundreds for centuries to continue to expand that understanding of democracy. And having that question, the answer to that question, start at the beginning of our country's sort of founding, for me, helps put everyday actions into perspective. And when we look at, say, the Black Lives Matter movement or the actions since 2016, 2017, that culminating moment with the death of Trayvon Martin that really pushed for police reform, right? I think we can see that there has been progress. Most of it is at the local level. There's been some statewide initiatives. Not much federal action has been taken. But in the grand scheme of things, right, that progress has to be positioned against systems that have been in place for decades, if not centuries, working in the opposite direction. And so the everyday actions of, say, my students or of individuals in these protest movements, right, has to really zero in on the wins that they get either in their own community or in their city or their state to understand how they are influencing politics with a broader understanding that their everyday action has to be part of a much bigger, oftentimes multi-generational movement if we really expect to see like systemic or institutional long-lasting change.
So that thinking of the words, the pursuit of a more perfect union, is that those words, or is that aspirational? I mean, you weren't framing things. You're not that old. Yeah. But it really begs that question. What are we pursuing? And I appreciate your answer in terms of, your thoughtful answer in terms of, you got to look at it as a whole, you know, not disparate pieces. But this is the whole that we're dealing with, and trying to tease out what part I can play in this whole. And I don't want to keep trying to avoid using the word system because that's a loaded word. Yeah. But the whole, this is it. So where do I fit in? And will I really move that needle or advance the ball before my time's up? And anyway.
Yeah. And I think for me, it comes down to expectations, right? And there's really very few individuals throughout the course of history who have changed the direction of the country, right? Or have changed the country in memorable ways where we look at that person and we're like, oh, that person really made a difference, right? Like, especially when it comes to Black history or Black politics, right? There's maybe a handful of people in the last 100 years where we'd point to and say that one individual, we can easily identify them as a change maker. So our expectations for change really need to be centered around, okay, what type of change can we make in our individual lives, in our family, in our community, that's going to build on what everyone else is doing that can help lead to a larger movement of change until we identify that one individual who might lead that movement or who might be the person within that movement or coming from that movement that we then say, oh, that one person took it over the top, right? That one person helped propel us.
That flag carrier we can identify and rally around, if you will. I'm sure you've thought more about it than I have, even to the point of, is a flag carrier helpful?
Right.
Or is it, it's not helpful to whatever action that's being taken. Are your students, are they listening? Or I hear you, Dr. Towler. I'm gonna assent to what you say because I want a passing grade out of your class. But am I buying what you're selling?
So I do believe that there's a good number of my students who come out of my classes with a deeper understanding of politics and what their individual political power may be. But again, it oftentimes takes more than just one class, right? Just like it takes more than just one conversation or more than just one friend or family member telling you, you know, politics is important, you need to vote. And so I clearly see students coming out of my classes with a deeper understanding of politics, and some come out, you know, wholeheartedly expressing to me that they feel like politics is important to them and they want to participate. But for many others, it's also just, as you said, another sort of step in their degree, more so than anything else. Mm-hmm. And so I really try to impression upon, especially the younger generation, that the way that they decide to engage with politics is not only going to influence their lives, but it's going to influence their friends' lives, their families' lives, and the next generation's lives, right? And time again, we see studies show that once you decide to vote and to get engaged and participate in politics, the odds of you doing so again only go up, right? It's not like you vote and all of a sudden you don't want to vote anymore, right? It's far more likely that you're going to vote once, and then you're going to be voting again and again and again. And that then is passed down to the next generation, right? To either your kids or your younger cousins or nieces or nephews, they see you voting and they feel, oh, that's something that maybe I want to do, right? And it opens that door. And those are the types of sort of decisions and understandings of politics that I want the younger students and younger generation to take away, is that just the simple act can be an influence on others in of itself, right? Regardless of the outcome. And placing that in, again, this historical understanding of what these political acts have meant, especially to the Black community over time, right? That these acts, one, haven't always been available, two, have oftentimes come with the threat of
death,
violence or death, right? And three, have been, the act itself has been a political statement for much of the Black community throughout American history, regardless of the outcome, right? There's many instances of Black communities voting, going to the polls, knowing wholeheartedly that there's not a candidate out there that's going to win, that's actually going to represent them. But the act of voting in of itself is politics for much of Black people's history in America. And so trying to, again, get younger students, younger generations, especially of Black students, to understand this, younger Black people to understand this, can put a different spin on what it means to participate in politics, to sort of push past some of the apathy associated with leaning on representatives or looking towards policy, and grounded it in a larger historical narrative of what politics means and the role that simple political acts have played for some U.S. citizens throughout American history.
You bring up a ton of things I want to comment on. One thing, literally yesterday, I had the pleasure of speaking with a gentleman who was born in England, lived in Australia, and now resides in Sacramento. And I don't know how we got on the conversation, but he said he gave an assessment of lived life here in the U.S. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, obviously, that we have a go-it-alone, very insular way of going about life. He says, that's not the case, he said. in England. I said, you do know England, right? Yeah, and the history and the, and all. He said, yeah. He said, but my sense is that there's more of a social communal contract in England than there is here. Now, I don't want to go down that rabbit trail of comparing England to the U.S., but it brought up the question that I often ask, and I'm going to ask Dr. Towler now. Give me a working definition, a Dr. Towler working definition of community. What is community to you, and what does that look like here, right now, 2025?
I wonder if your friend would have had a different answer 15, 20 years ago.
That's a good question.
Something that I, you know, lean on in a lot of my work, both in the classroom and research, is an understanding of what are called constitutional moments, where there are moments where we as Americans really sit back and reflect upon how democratic our country is and whether we are living up to this idea of the Constitution, right? Whether we actually fulfilling this idea of American democracy. And we've, for the most part, right, pushed towards individualism as a country, because that's, again, what the tenets of the Constitution were prioritizing. There was a fear, the founding of the country was based upon a fear of monarchy, a fear of government taking over, right, following the American Revolution. And so much of the protections in the Constitution that our institutions to this day are built upon are protecting individualism, protecting our rights as American individuals to be free from government telling us what to do. And so that individual identity, right, has been the sort of common thread throughout much of American history until we get to a moment where we as a country say, well, we've prioritized individualism to a point that there are certain individuals that have, you know, taken advantage and have exploited others and have way more rights. And we're not actually living up to this idea of democracy that we want to live up to, right? And we can look back to moments like the Civil War and Reconstruction, moments like the Civil Rights Movement, right? And arguably the sort of Obama era presidency as these moments where we as a country come together more so and move away from maybe an individual identity more towards a larger American societal identity that wants to see a new type of democracy. And so I feel like today we are absolutely more grounded in a era of individualism, an era where we are actually pushing back against maybe a constitutional moment with President Obama, a moment where the country came together, said we want to see a different version of American democracy. We want to elect a president twice that has never been done before, right? We want to elect the first black or non-white president and come together for this moment. But then after that moment, we fall back into this more consistent theme of American individualism. And I think, you know, since 2016 on, we've really seen that idea of American individualism be used to polarize the country, to make people sort of hypervigilant when it comes to their political identity and their worries. And to push back against this idea that if we all come together, we'll be a better democracy, and push more towards this historical norm of, but we need to make sure that individuals are able to do what they want and that other people aren't telling us what to do, namely the government.
So is community, I'll put words in your mouth as I ask, is community a tribe then?
I wouldn't say a tribe. I think, and the reason I didn't come with a straight answer for that is because I think community has a number of different definitions depending on the different group or population within America, if you will, that you're talking about. And so as a whole, I think that Americans' identity of community shifts and changes over time. And I think that for many Americans, there might not be a consistent overarching theme of community, but that their community is more grounded in smaller ideas and identities of who they are and who they live with and the, you know, race and ethnic groups that they come from, the languages they speak. Those to me are more so definitions of community that don't reach as far as the entire country, right? But you do see different ideas of community throughout American politics within subgroups and subpopulations, other than these constitutional moments, right? I do feel like we do have moments where we as Americans do feel like we have some identity worth coming together for, right? And that identity, in my opinion, is a democratic one, and we want to build more democracy. But outside of a few moments in American history, right, we are very individualistic. We don't necessarily have an overarching theme of community that brings us together as a country very often.
Well, that seems to, and I've gotten the high sign that my time is up, but that seems to not only be antithetical, but I don't, you're Dr. Toller, so you'll show me how this all teases out. In the age of AI,
yeah,
and fluid borders, I can get from here to Sydney, Australia in 12 hours. And we're going to be more individual, more, dare I say, isolated. That just seems like that's a losing proposition.
And I think you're right, and I think we're seeing that play out in the way that American politics at right now with the current administration is being sort of isolated, if you will, opposed by other countries, by other groups across the world. A lot of the ideas that are coming out of America right now from our political leadership are seen as very isolationist, as very, we don't necessarily want to be in community with the rest of the world and with different populations.
So does that get pushed down and lived out to the point of, you know, bring it really home in Oak Park, in Sacramento, in Land Park, in dealing with issues of homelessness? You know, as I like to, the rhetorical question that God posited to Cain, where's your brother? And Cain is, am I my brother's keeper? Well, short answer is yes.
Yeah, right.
Yes, you are. But no, I'm not. Even though I was responsible for his death, I'm not responsible for him. That's, how does political science in everything that it is gets lived out in a way that is transformative for the 95817.
Yeah, so I think we're seeing some of that play out now where groups of people, different regions, different areas who have had or have developed a different identity, a different definition of community than what's being pushed down from national politics, right? Are resisting and also opposing this push towards individual and this push away from working together in their own ways. And so there's absolutely ways that cities like Sacramento, communities like Oak Park can and have been coming together in opposition to this idea that we don't need to work together, that we shouldn't be in community, that we should just focus on our own individual selves and our own self-interest. And we've seen that, but it makes it harder, especially when you have a federal government that can use resources and use power to make it difficult for community organizations, for communities coming together to get things done, right? And so as we move from a time, arguably a more sort of democratic time, a time of more community, I would say, you know, during the Obama era, to a time where community is frowned upon, and where the national government and powers that be are working to dismantle communities, especially communities that they disagree with, mm-hmm. right? It makes it harder for that community work to happen, but it's still there and it still can happen. It just takes much more effort, oftentimes much more resources and much more investment. Yeah,
I just read either today or yesterday, Harvard University has lost its ability to intake foreign students.
Yep, and they filed a lawsuit this morning.
Yeah.
Again, and that's an example of Harvard as a community deciding we're not going to allow these ideas of individualism, of sort of these ideas of self-interest to push us apart, right? We're going to try and fight back and maintain this community, including international students. And, you know, some might say including undocumented students and including students that others on the outside or those in the current, you know, political majority would say aren't deserving of being part of those thoughts or those rights, or that we don't want them in community with us, right? We need to focus on them, on our own individual benefit, right? It, regardless of what it means for everybody else.
Dr. Christopher Toller, whoever brought you to Sac State, CSU Sacramento, I applaud them. Thank you so much for all the work you're doing. You have to come back, because I did not get to talk about the Black Voter Project, and that is what brought us together. Gave an outstanding lecture a few months ago, and I want to speak to that maybe as we get closer to November, even though there's probably not a whole lot going to be going on this November, but there'll be something.
You might be surprised. And I'd love to talk more about it, because I think that project and its emphasis on Black voters in particular, and if you will, the Black community, right, speaks to exactly what we kind of finished talking about, that there are different ways to understand and look at community. They're just not always in mainstream political discussions.
That's the ultimate tease. Thank you, Dr. Toller.
Thank you so much.